The reason meadows exist is because prehistoric mankind cleared them through fire in order to create a target for their hunting, to attract the cows there, the bison there.
What about lightning?
Yeah, but lightning might strike once, but it never strikes twice in the same spot.
So you're saying that prehistoric man had to burn the area?
Had to burn clearings to attract cattle to graze there, which they then were able to kill very easily. So grass, essentially, its niche is humans' desire to eat cattle meat. It's a symbiotic relationship between humans and grass.
What did the cows used to eat before then?
Well, the grass evolved to be delicious to cows in order that the humans would clear clearings for them.
Oh, this all makes sense.
Yeah?
No.
And grass and humans are basically in a symbiotic relationship.
Well,
I think it's time for us
to go. We got a minute left.
I don't know.
You don't know? You want to just stay here?
We could for a while.
I think
I see Dr. Jalas outside.
Yeah, he's peering through the window.
He looks pretty angry, actually. Yes. He's fuming.
That's okay. He can wait.
Just lock the door.
No, I think that I'd like to close with this this cover of Poker Face.
Oh, dear God.
Yeah, no, I really like this.
Can we say God on the air?
No, it's not FCC.
G/D, right?
GD, the big G. So we'll end with this, and we'll see what you guys think.
I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please.
Bye, everyone.
It's good to be you.
And of course, I'll still be here for the next hour.
Just stay where you are.
I'll just stay here.
And after he's been hooked, I'll play the one that's on his heart. Oh, 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 oh. I'll get him high, show him what I've got. Oh, 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 oh. I'll get him high, show him what I've got. Carried mine, oh, he can't read my poker face. Carried mine, oh, he can't read my poker face. My poker face, my poker face. My poker face, my poker face. I wanna roll with him, a hot pair we will be. A little gambling's fun when you're with me. Russian roulette is not the same without a gun. Baby, when it's love, if it's not rough, it isn't fun. Oh, 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 oh. I'll get him high, show him what I've got. Oh, 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 oh. I'll get him high, show him what I've got. Carried mine, oh, he can't read my poker face. Carried mine, oh, he can't read my poker face. I won't tell you that I love you just to hug you, cause I'm bluffing with my mouth and I'm not lying. I'm just stunning with my left blue gunning. Just like a chick in the casino, take your bank before I pay you. Well, I promise this. Carried mine, oh, he can't read my poker face.
La vida hay que vivirla, no hay que tomarla en serio. Si te descuidas mucho, te lleva al cementerio. Es ferio, no te quedes en el medio. Es ferio, no lo tomes muy en serio. A ti te recomiendo, oye el programa es ferio, oye el programa es ferio. Somos la voz local de nuestro hemisferio.
Join us for Sferio, the local voice of our hemisphere, Fridays from 6 to 7 p.m. on WMBR Cambridge and around the world at WMBR.org.
I'm sorry, did you say marhaban? Yes, marhaban. I'm a Dr. Jalis Sakran, and I welcome you. Aha! It is the winter solstice here in Cambridge, almost. And many of my Christian friends and cohabitants are celebrating their own version of the solstice, which they have now in their culture been celebrating for, I would say, around 1700 years. But it is a celebration, and it is nice to see that they are embracing something which is very natural and very close to the earth. I just wish I would see a little bit more acknowledgement of what the New Age movement, or in this case, the very, very old age movement, has brought to our modern culture. Here to discuss this with me is first Professor Levine. Professor Levine, welcome.
Thank you. It's a very profound pleasure of mine today to be here.
The profundity is shared. Professor Levine is a Jewish professor of mysticism.
New Age mysticism is my specialty.
And your speciality.
Yes, and I believe, although you said that this winter solstice has been celebrated for roughly 1,700 years in the West, each season, each year, its period of celebration lengthens. So, for example, this year it was celebrated since about mid-November until now, I believe. And this celebration is augured by chimes on the radio and such.
The auguring chimes, which we have been hearing for several moons at this point. Well, it's so good, of course, to have you, Professor Levine. We also have with us Aurora, vocal therapist.
Thank you for having me on the show, Dr. Jollis.
Well, thank you for being there with us, Aurora.
It's so good to be here year after year, week after week, and to hear your voices and to be part of the circle.
And might I add that, Aurora, you personally have always been there for me when I needed you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Levine, and the same to you as well.
And I'd like everyone that's out there and listening to know that during the hour, if you'd like to call in and be there for us in any way, please feel free to call in. We have two lines available, which is the number is 617-253-8810. And we'll be happy to simply commune with you here on this dark and long night. Though the nights are shortening once again as we begin reaching towards the equinox and later towards the opposite solstice.
Well, and they're soon going to lengthen, no? We had the solstice a few days ago.
You know, there is one theory among some ancient New Age scholars that although we are currently living in an age where the seasons revolve in the cycle and the days lengthen, they wax, they wane, the moon waxes and the moon wanes, I wax and I wane. However, at some point in the near future, this cycle will be broken. There will be a sort of rupture in the cyclical nature of the universe. And at some point, days will begin to lengthen and lengthen and lengthen until they're maybe 24, 48, 63, 172 hours long.
And thus, inevitably, the circle will once again break.
And I think even so-called scientists have begun to acknowledge this kind of thing with their theory of the Big Bang, where the idea is that there was some initial bang, which I guess was very big, and it banged and banged and banged, and the universe began to expand from the size of a mustard seed to the size of a peppercorn to the size of a coriander seed, and eventually beyond the realm of seeds whatsoever. And the theory is that eventually we'll get some sort of oscillation where the universe goes back to its seed-like nature and again becomes a coriander seed or a mustard seed or a peppercorn.
What's known as the great universal crunching, which is inevitable.
And it's such a beautiful image as well, the different sizes, the different textures and tastes. We can feel the tinge of the universe in all of our senses through that metaphor.
Like a nodule in the folds of one's voice.
or a pimple on the surface of one's skin.
That image, of course, of a pimple speaks most to me as a transdermal mediator. The idea of a pimple, of a zit, the universe being an expanding and then eventually contracting zit with these pus-like existence.
Well, not to change the subject, but I was eating this substance the other night known as ice cream. Ice cream. And it's a very wonderful food composed of a sort of crystalline substance of milk and cream and sugar. And I wondered, is the coldness of the ice cream essential to its wonderful taste? Or is it merely an artifact of the fact that the ice cream must be frozen in order to keep its composition crystalline? In other words, if one were, say, to create some sort of pressure chamber, which would allow us to lower the pressure and thus change the freezing temperature and allow us to have warm ice cream remaining in its crystalline form, would it be superior to the cold ice cream?
Well, now, Professor Levine, you are aware that crystallized ice cream is what's known in America as freezer burn. It's the undesirable consequence of melting and then refreezing slowly the ice cream.
Well, what is the
I'd say it's more like a gel.
It's the subatomic structure of
sort of
the ice cream.
An amorphous, like glass. If there were a glass equivalent of dairy, it would be ice cream.
And how does that differ from the more Italian gelato?
Well, I believe the gelato uses in its molecular structure a something called the Higgs boson, or the Higgs boson particle.
If I recall correctly, that particle, it has a flavor.
Is it Higgs boson or Higgs boson?
I'm not entirely sure. There is, of course, a Higgs boson, which many physicists believe may be the underlying explanation of the universe. But as we know,
I've heard that there's a collider in the country of Europe known as the Large Cauldron Collider, or Large Cauldron Collider. Is that correct? Collider.
I think it's the Large Hadron Boson.
Hoson. Mm.
Well, we hear it.
We're not scientists.
Music
here.
For human beings are often, you know, it's common for us to make mistakes with names.
It's in our intent rather than in what we say that you can get the good message.
My point in bringing that up, of course, was that some people believe that by causing these little tiny specks of dust known as Higgs boson particles to collide,
We can discover whether or not there is a dog.
No. That instead, this sort of colliding of these pieces of dust or seeds, as one might prefer, could cause the universe to cease to exist as we know it, could cause a black hole to form and to suck in the entire universe as we know it. Some even believe that this has already occurred, and we are now no more than characters in a dream.
It's a very interesting view. I mean, how could one know that one was not simply the figment of a friend's imagination?
Or worse yet, an enemy's imagination.
Would it really be worse to be the evil character in a dream?
Well, of course, if one's life takes a turn for the worse, one experiences misfortune, then one might very well imagine that one is a character in the dream of a malevolent enemy who wishes harm only to befall oneself.
Yeah, but if we believe that the universe is controlled by a malevolent being, then really we have no chance, there is no hope for escape if the universe is controlled by an adversary.
And yet again, we are often referred to as our worst enemy. So can we not be a figment of our own dream, of our own imagination?
A victim of our own malfeasance.
Well, I know that I am not my worst enemy because I happen to know who my worst enemy is.
Hmm.
I've had many encounters with him in my past. And fortunately, he's now in a prison in Minnesota.
The Archduke Gamgron.
Exactly.
I've not heard of this Archduke.
Well, this Archduke was a fellow disciple of mine, of our former guru. And he, in contrast to myself, was studying the art of the New Age solely for the benefit that would accrue to him from writing these books, these self-help books.
He was a follower of what has been called the left-handed path, the path of really embracing this world and falling in love with the self.
Exactly. This is really wonderful music. It sort of reminds me of all the New Age thought that occurred in the Old West in the United States. There's actually a lot of deep folk wisdom coursing through the veins of all the characters and the families and the villages and the frontier.
Of course, this is Andreas Vollenweider in his Cosmopoly
is like Monopoly and cosmology combined.
And this track is number 7, Under One Moon.
This idea of commercializing space.
I've also often wondered what a New Age Monopoly game would be like.
It's almost exactly the same, except that instead of building buildings and hotels, one simply builds huts and homes, and no one ever charges rent. And everyone wins.
And you try to gain enlightenment rather than money.
Surprisingly, there is a jail, but it is more like a communal holding area.
It might be a jail of the soul.
A mind jail.
The body, perhaps, we might say, is the jail of the soul. And therefore, in this New Age monopoly, jail would merely be the body.
For those who do not attain enlightenment, perhaps quick enough.
Now, going back to this question of there being no loser, but everyone being a winner, I wonder if there's something essential in human nature that requires that there be losers for us to truly enjoy the fruits of our winnings.
I believe that that's perhaps an idea which has been passed down by our parents, by our society.
And we do have these games, like the game of cricket and rugby and football, where one team wins and the other loses.
Professor Levine, I feel that this is one method that people have used in order to push themselves to points of further development, the idea of competitiveness and the desire, sort of greed, to gain an ascendancy over another group. But the method that I have used, you see, that one person would be unable to exceed a point which is slightly greater than that of his opponent, And if he has no opponent, then he is unable to improve. But if one is able to, if you like, play against oneself, one's previous self, and to cast off old skins, then one has an unlimited potential for growth.
Hmm. So this is like the arcade game point system, one might say.
Hmm. One competes against oneself.
One's previous high score.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I wonder that we have these other games that children play, such as the game of catch. And one thing I've always observed about this game of catch is that there are no winners and there are no losers. There's merely a ball which is caught.
Or
dropped, but then picked up and thrown again.
And yet there are yet other games that adults play in which no one wins, such as the game of love or tic-tac-toe.
Or chess.
Only when playing against you, Dr. Jollis, king of stalemates.
Well, what's that supposed to mean?
I've noticed whenever you play chess with me or with any other person, you try your best to cause a stalemate.
Well, I think a draw is the most perfect ending.
It certainly has its beauty. Both can enjoy the gameplay. That being upset due to a loss, or too elated and greedy due to a win.
Mm-hmm.
Might I read a quote from Ram Dass?
Please do so.
That sounds wonderful.
Divine Mother Kali, she is my mother, she is my moon, she is my father, she is my child, she is my brother, she is the grass, she is my lover, she is the dew. She is my son. Look at how much she can teach. Her tongue, dripping blood. A circle of skulls round her neck. A dagger in one hand, giving birth in the other. The whole process of nature, how exquisitely subtle.
Now, Kali, of course, is the wife of Krishna in the Hindu belief system.
Can anyone imagine that a woman as full and seductive as that is not going to teach something? Is not going to continue to teach something?
I think that it may be this competitive nature, going back to a previous topic, that disallows us from experiencing true peace. We are always attempting to best one another.
But this sort of conflicts with the idea that we are all truly one being, which is a sort of a common trope in mystical thought and in New Age thought, that somehow we're all really part of one single soul corpus, some single soul body. We're all parts of this whole. So if we're all parts of this whole, is it possible for us to compete against one another? Does the right hand compete against the left ear?
I believe the problem comes in when we do not perceive ourselves as such, when we do not realize that we are all part of a whole.
But let me tell you about the way bhakti works. You just love until you and the beloved become one.
That's such a beautiful thought.
That's another quote from the Guru Ram Dass.
And of course there's the idea that we are all one, despite our contact or lack thereof.
If we are one, though, I wonder what one we are. Are we one mustard seed? Coriander seed? Sliver of saffron? Cinnamon stick? Clove?
When you consider the vast array of conclusions that can be drawn from the statement, we are one, think how freeing it must be to be two. If we made a statement like, we are all two, and then one person steps forward and says, you and I are not the same. It's possible. He may be of one and I of the other. Or I feel very alone. I must be of one. And all the world is of the other. Mm. How freeing.
Of course, the ancient Persians, the Zoroastrians, did believe that the essence of the universe is two, not one. There are two forces. One force of light and one force of dark, and that these two forces are in this sort of competitive flux throughout history, and they are both exemplified by the human body. In fact, the diaphragm in the human body separates the symbolism of these two forces. Above the diaphragm, we have the lungs and the heart and the brain, these forces of purity. Below the diaphragm, we have the animal forces of lust and reproduction and digestion.
I believe that this idea perhaps simplifies too much the light and the dark, the animalistic and the enlightened somehow. I believe that these things are all mixed up, and that the things that we experience, the feelings, emotions, and even the enlightened logic that we experience, that they all come from the same place as that animalistic instinct.
Well, there is a view within Jewish mysticism, exemplified by the writings of the Arizal, which is that the essence of the fall of the universe is not the existence of evil, which of course existed from the very start, but rather the admixture of good and evil, and that the whole process of mankind in liberating the universe is to separate out these two strands of good and evil to achieve a certain balance.
To somewhat unravel the yarn of existence.
The yarn of the fall.
But it does not allow the soul that yearns for something mixed in the middle. I mean, not all is good and evil. There are certain urges that either have a good effect and evil intention, or evil effect and good intention, or it's so difficult to judge.
Or no intention at all.
Or no intention at all, exactly.
I mean, zombie sin. Yes, I mean, zombies, of course, sin. Mm-hmm. They kill, they eat brains, but and yet they have no evil intention.
Well, like a knife may cut one's finger or may kill, but without a brain, a knife is merely a tool or a force of nature, and hence can do no evil, although it may do great harm. If we have any zombie lawyers in our listenership, I invite you please to call. The number is 617-253-8810. And we have merely two lines available. Our operator is gesturing in sign language that we had a call earlier, which we lost due to board error.
Yes, speaking of the ancient Persians, the Zoroastrians, it reminds me of a Talmudic saying regarding the ancient Persians, which says, this is regarding the marital duties between a husband and wife. And the Talmud states that there must be close bodily contact between the spouses during the act of love. This is in contradistinction to the ancient Persians, who would perform their marital duties in their clothing. And in fact, the legal pronouncement of the Talmud is that a husband who says, I will not perform my marital duties unless my wife wears her clothes and I mine, must divorce his wife and must pay her marriage settlement.
her dowry.
Her dowry, yes. In addition, a man is forbidden to perform his marital duty in the daytime, according to this one rabbi. And he brought support for his view from the biblical passage which says, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." Now, this seems initially puzzling. Why should "thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself" imply that one cannot perform the marital duty during the day? So, another sage of the Talmud explained that a husband might observe something in his wife which he doesn't like, and she would therefore become loathsome to him. So in order to prevent this lack of love, the duty must be done at night.
Such a strange and interesting idea to me, the idea that you would take someone and not, through your emotional love, overlook any physical abnormalities. That you would not embrace the person as a whole, seeing their spirit as well as their body. Mm,
yes. Perhaps this is directed at the lowest common denominator of husband. But it's interesting that bodily contact is required, and I wonder, often people like bodily contact more if the lights are off, if there's dark. Somehow it accentuates the sensual feeling of human touch without any visual stimulus. I see Dr. Jalas is thinking very deeply, pondering this idea.
Well, does it not occur that it is a byword that the blind hear better than the seeing, and the deaf read sign language better than the hearing?
Hmm.
It is only natural that when one sense is deprived, that the whole energy of the mind rushes to the interpretation of the remaining senses. So when I close the lights, I begin to hear more keenly and acutely.
I see.
And hearing, after all, is a form of feeling.
Well, I wonder if one might say that the ultimate form of marital contact is hearing the cooing of one's spouse rather than touching the body of one's spouse. And therefore, one might forbid lights as well as bodily contact and focus only on cooing noises. Well, I think the engineers are working on some issues, so I'll read a little bit of Ram Dass while we're waiting. You are the universe. You are all form. You are the breath. You are the river. You are the void. You are the desire to be enlightened. You are enlightened.
That's such a beautiful image there.
The idea that one simply is the form.
And the void.
It's very challenging.
So many of the difficulties that we have, that we have to embrace different forms of ourselves.
The idea of individuality.
Individuality and togetherness, and being the void and everything, and at the same time.
Well, I think this issue is once again this concept of the left-handed path. The left-handed versus the right-handed path, the idea of embracing one's individuality and one's presence and existence in this life, in this world, or rejecting these ideas and bearing deeply in mind sensations of altruism.
Right.
And the idea of karma as a universal force.
Probably the most famous example of a person who studied the New Age wisdom and power and took the left-handed approach would probably be Oprah Winfrey. And of course, Oprah Winfrey is a very influential person, and I believe that she studied with some very famous gurus in India in order to achieve this kind of influential charisma.
Well, it certainly has benefited her, has it not?
Yes, I mean, I believe she is the wealthiest woman in the world, which is quite remarkable.
Even wealthier than the Queen?
The Queen actually is not particularly wealthy.
Hmm.
The Queen, you refer to the Queen of Finland.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And how does she use this capitalistic wealth of hers?
Well, I'm not entirely sure what she does with her money. But she has been remarkably successful. And she has used this success to amass a very large fortune. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that, per se, but it is the left-handed way, as Dr. Jalas mentioned.
I mean, I recall a very influential essay by a comedian on his dream of impregnating this extremely wealthy figure.
Yes.
You know, with the hopes of, you know, thereby gaining a foothold into this vast fortune.
Hmm. It's amazing that someone would even consider denaturing and degrading their inner self, their beauty, their beautiful soul, just for some fiscal gain, some temporary green pieces of paper.
Well, the Talmud has a saying which says that one should push away with the left hand and pull in with the right hand. What this means is that one should use the left hand and the power of the material world in limited quantities, and one should instead focus on the power of the spiritual being, as symbolized by the right hand, to bring wealth to oneself.
Now, what is this dichotomy between the right and left hand? Where does this find its roots?
Well, I think it's just a sort of part of human nature that some of us have one hand that is better coordinated and more powerful than the other. I'm not sure if it's really more of a social fact or some innate fact about mankind that we have a strong hand and a weak hand. Of course, many people don't realize, but there's also footedness besides handedness. Some people are right-footed, some people are left-footed, and it may not correspond with their handedness. This is particularly relevant when it comes to surfing in the ocean. One can adopt a left-footed surf stance or a right-footed surf stance. I learned this in my many decades of wandering the islands of Indonesia while I was a young mystic, and I found that surfing would often stimulate my mystical thoughts.
Mm-hmm. So, interestingly, I sent someone out to do some research on Oprah, and I found that actually the world's richest women are the widow and daughter of Walton. A certain Walton.
The Walmart.
Who founded Walmart. And they are each worth around $20 billion, which is around 10 times more than Oprah.
Mm. It's sort of the Walmart experience is, to me, it's a sort of mind disease that has been propagated. We all go to this place despite knowing that they abuse their workers, that they They go through all sorts of evil practices in order to give products at a slightly lower price, and we are eager to grab them up, even though we know that buying these products will put that blood on our hands.
Mm-hmm.
Is it worth it to save a few dollars?
I think so.
It probably is. I think that that it is a mechanism that is worth observing. It's like why would the wealthy permit laws to be passed which would deprive them of their wealth? So naturally, the system that is in place will at best maintain the separation between the wealthy and the poor, but more likely will simply enlarge this gap. And to prevent revolution, the system also has mechanisms for randomly selecting members of the impoverished class and thrusting them into this wealthy society.
Speaking of thrusting, if any listener would like to thrust their voice into our conversation and allow us to receive their vocal thrusts, the number to call is 617-253-8810. That's 617-253-8810. I wonder if I should read again from Ram Dass. One to me, and you finally understand. The message you communicate with another human being has nothing to do with what you say. It has nothing to do with the look on the musculature of your face. It's much deeper than that, much deeper. It's the vibrations that emanate from you. So vibrations, sort of idea that true communication, true message that we send others is something deeper than our facial expressions or our words. It's vibrations.
Of course, this resonates with me. As a vocal therapist, I often can tell a person's soul. I can understand them through their vibrations. And there is a huge level of communication in which we subconsciously receive, until we train ourselves. The vibrations of a person can tell you their moods, their desires, even their spirituality.
And some creatures are able to receive these vibrations more clearly than others. And this is another quote. If your vibrations are paranoid, that's what's being received. And when you're around pets, birds or cats particularly, or very young children, or very flipped out psychotics, they will know you immediately. You can come and say, "Hello, dear, how are you?" And the dog will growl. You can't come on because they're listening to the vibrations that hand is reaching out and sending. And you realize that every moment you are a full statement of your entire being, and you're sending out vibrations that are affecting everything around you, which in turn is affecting everything that comes back. And when you meet somebody who is caught in the world of we and them, and you are him, to that person, and you get caught in his mind net, you are both just intensifying one another's paranoia. You have to avoid being caught in the mind net of others sometimes.
Of course, this relates back to some of the quantum mechanical ideas which we have discussed before in this show. And we are experiments, but we are also observers. And our mere presence influences not only on a visual level, but on a quantum mechanical level, influences everything around us. So it's important to sort of understand where the rest of the world is, to understand your surroundings, because as you influence it, it will influence you as well.
An expression that I've heard several times recently that has intrigued me is mind grapes.
Mind grapes.
Mind grapes. And I've often wondered, you know, since I first heard this expression, what might its meaning be? What is its origin? Is it a common American expression? Professor Levine, Aurora, have you heard?
I've never actually heard this before, but it's, again, a beautiful metaphor, and we seem to be coming up with lots of those today. You can imagine that using a part of your mind is much like squeezing a grape, and that the juices run down and nourish you.
And if you allow the grape to sit in the sun for a long time,
it will shrivel. And become more concentrated in flavor.
And if you introduce some bacteria,
you can get a fermented
mind grape.
Mind wine.
A mind wind wine.
A wind.
A mind liqueur.
Possibly.
Now, I've heard that some ancient tribes in the Amazon would stew the brains of their enemies in a sort of vat, a fermented vat, and produce a liquor made of their enemies' brains. And it was very delicious, but it also contained many prions.
These are those that contracted kuru?
Exactly, meaning that they all stabbed themselves in the stomach.
Well, in a metaphorical sense, they died of laughter. They would laugh themselves to death.
Not perhaps the most undesirable mode of death.
It's shocking.
Shocking, but funny.
Have you ever experienced laughter in a prolonged... Sometimes I enter these euphoric states. It happened once on the show, actually. And I will laugh for several minutes, sometimes up to 10 minutes of just pure laughter. At the end of it, my body is exhausted.
Well, I've often said that laughter is the greatest tonic for sorrow, unless it kills you.
Well, it still is a tonic for sorrow, for your own.
But if it kills you, it may cause sorrow to your family members.
That's true. It's always important to be mentally balanced and to understand the intricacies of happiness, of laughter, of sorrow, of tears, that each has its time, and it's much like the mind grape that has been shriveled in the sun for much too long receives a certain high concentration.
But I've also heard it said among the ancients that a fit of laughter, of intense laughter that is prolonged, can actually lead to brief prophetic states. Where one is able to, so to speak, bend the curve of time in one's mind through this intense laughter.
I think the difficulty is in sacrificing a single mind grape without the infection spreading to the remaining mind grapes. I mean, is a lawnmower really preferable to a goat on the lawn?
I think some famous linguist said that analyzing love through a linguistic analysis is like picking flowers with a lawnmower. Or maybe picking flowers with a plowing device.
In the sense that you end up with love juice and no actual love, that you only end up with a love mulch, more of.
A love compost, maybe.
That it can be used to feed other love, but not your own.
Sort of take the love of one's past, take its waste products, throw it into the compost heap, add some wood chips.
I somewhat object to the term compost because it is so graphic. You know, I think it would be more suitable if we used words like fertilizer or poop.
I think compost
uses compost of more poop than poop, yes.
And creates something which can be used as a fertilizer.
I'm not using poop as an excrement specifically. I mean poop in the general, you know, just, oh, that's poop.
Well, the thing about compost is that you need more than poop. You need sources of nitrogen. which the poop can provide, but you also need sources of carbon.
I think all you need in life can be provided by poop, suitably arranged. It's all there.
No, there's not enough carbon. You need some wood. Wood chips?
Wood and poop.
Yes. In fact, I've heard that some organic farmers will, when they have their barn enclosed for the winter, they will keep their pigs or cows in the barn. And these cows and pigs will, of course, excrete upon the floor of the barn. Instead of removing the excrement, they will merely add a layer of wood chips and
knock
hay.
Down the barn.
No, and allow an additional layer of excrement and build it up and up and up
until
it's about 3 feet high. But the nice thing is that this creates a very wonderful, rich compost to be used in farming afterwards. And an additional byproduct is that it actually heats the barn through the decomposition of the organic,
which is an exothermic process.
Yes,
that's beautiful. I think that kind of forward-thinking farming, which will keep the land of this country and others fertile, unlike the arid, salty sands
of Arabia,
of Mexico. And over-farming is dangerous and subtle thing, but who among us can resist her siren song?
I can.
Yeah,
through my journeys, I have found that rummaging for food, foraging.
Well, have any of you experienced over farming your yards when you plant your fruit and vegetable orchards?
Yeah, I over farmed the garden on my windowsill, and it is now barren.
I had a small plot as a child, but we were always careful to rotate alfalfa with the tomatoes.
Well, this reminds me of a sort of cross-religious theme that I've encountered. Many religions, of course, frown upon intercourse of man and wife as being somehow impure. But I believe in the Islamic faith, correct me if I'm wrong, the marital delights are compared to a fresh field which one may plow in any way that one desires. And similarly, in the Talmudic tradition, the marital delights are compared to a piece of meat from an animal, which one again may cook in various ways. One may salt, one may smoke, one may broil, one may fry, one may grill. And there's no restriction on the way one gets to enjoy this pleasure.
Well, now, as far as I know, there are restrictions, and depending on one's particular religious traditions, there may be greater or lesser or fewer restrictions. But I think that, unfortunately, we are so near the end of the hour that we are forced to postpone,
to maybe forego this particular these restrictions
for this evening
or forever,
if you desire. Well, once again, the hour is
nine
ended. It is so quick, but it's been wonderful with you here, both Aurora,
namaste,
and my friend here, Professor Levine.
Thank you. My pleasure today has been like a gaseous substance which fills to fill the void.
It's so full of gas. I am Dr. Jalis Sakran here on WMBR 88.1 FM with Music for Human, which is New Age Talk Radio with an emphasis on you. Stay tuned very, very shortly for Massachusetts Bay and Response, transmitted on this special solstice edition. Ma'a salama.
safety.
Number one,
cars and bikes stop at red lights.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two,
look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three,
cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four,
cars and bikes should stop for pedestrians and unsignalized crosswalks.
Be nice. Be legal. Be safe.
Brought to you as a public service by the Cambridge Bicycle Committee and this station.
Yeah.